listening to the BBC History Magazine on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I am your volunteer reader, Kim Chupa Cornell. Our first story is Live Locally, Live Sustainably, Live Medieval. If you want to live a sustainable life today, you need to think local. For that, you can channel the experience of the Middle Ages, as Dr. Ian Mortimer tells Dave Musgrove. When I have a spare moment, I dabble in making hazel hurdle fence panels. It's gloriously therapeutic. You get yourself a fat bundle of 6-foot-long straight hazel rods, ram a few of them vertically into the ground at regular intervals, and then cajole the rest of your rods through them on the horizontal, leaving them in and out of the uprights. The trick is to robustly bend the rods so that you can feel the fibers creaking and twisting through your palms, but you can't be so hard on the wood that it cracks and snaps. It's bad if that happens. I am a rank amateur at this, and the results of my labors are woefully rustic, but I like the process of getting there. If you're doing it properly, you're supposed to split the hazel rods in half, but I've yet to conquer that art. To see it done masterfully, there are loads of informative videos online of competent, serious chaps in forests teasing the wood into beautiful hurdle panels. People have been making hazel hurdle panels for millennia. In the Somerset Levels, archaeologists have excavated them in situ, where they were laid down in the Neolithic period as trackways to help people get across the boggy ground. They survive amazingly because peat grew up over them and protected them. The trickiest bit of making a hazel hurdle is procuring the rods. You have to coppice trees, i.e. cut them down to the base, in order to encourage the hazel to shoot up in straight stems. If you're managing a woodland, you would crop the coppiced hazel on a regular rotation every 5 to 7 years. It's a very sustainable building material because the wood grows back fast and parallel, and we know that in the Middle Ages, they were definitely managing their local woodlands to supply this. It's just one of many examples of sustainable living that our medieval forebears were engaged in, according to historian and author Dr. Ian Mortimer. They managed their resources in a way that they knew they could get continuing crops off. If you pollard or coppice a tree, it will grow back stronger. They knew all about that sort of thing. Locally sourced. For Mortimer, there's a lesson there for us. We should look back to the Middle Ages for inspiration for living sustainably today. Now, I know what you're thinking. Those medieval folks weren't living sustainably because they wanted to, but simply because they had to. It's certainly true, according to Ian Mortimer, that life in the 11th century in England was very precarious for many. He notes that there was a regular cycle of famine at the time, so much so that some parents were willing to sell their children into slavery because that was the child's best chance of survival. There wasn't much surplus around, and for most people, there wasn't ready access to markets to transfer the surplus anyway, so most communities were pretty much self-sufficient and heavily dependent on their own productivity and ingenuity. By the time we get to the 13th century, however, things are different. England was much more of a market economy, and a lot of goods were moving around. Surpluses could be transferred from places with plentiful supplies to areas in need. The precariousness of a subsistence economy was thus overcome. Nevertheless, communities continued to source most of their food and raw materials from their locality. The less distance it had to travel, the less vulnerable the society. Local production combined with a market economy is a very positive way of maximizing sustainability. Whether the Middle Ages had a concept of environmental protection or not, they certainly knew how to marshal their local resources and wider networks. And that included working together collectively and collaboratively. To avoid the specter of food shortages, medieval farmers had to manage their risks across the community, share good and bad land equitably among one another, and accept communal rules about what was gathered when, where, and by whom. Look through the manorial customs of medieval manors, and they'll be saying when the peasants can go take their pigs into the woods to get the beech mast from the ground, and when they're allowed to pick up the fallen sticks for their firewood, how much timber they're allowed to take for their houses, observes Mortimer. When you think about an open field system, which is what we had across most of central England, you can see how they divide all the strips of land into areas where no one's going to have all their land blighted by a frost pocket because it's all divided up and scattered. So there's an average sort of production level across all of the fields. Community values. What Ian Mortimer is describing there is a way of living communally, where resources were shared in a way that was seen as equitable. It had to be managed and rules observed, of course, and that's where the customs of the manor and the writ of the lord's local representative, the reeve, came into play. This wasn't some utopian land of harmony. Some people didn't conform. Sometimes there were disputes and disagreements, and sometimes the lords of the manor pressed hard with their demands on the peasants. But there was a strong element of cooperation among these communities to allow for this way of living. Living sustainably was only sustainable if they worked together. People in the Middle Ages would not have understood the concept of sustainable living. To them, it was just living. So you might take the view that this interpretation is simply historians today mirroring 21st century concerns and projecting them onto the past. Of course, that's true to an extent. History is always a reflection of the past. However, academics have been writing about this aspect of medieval life for quite a while. There is a very interesting paper written back in 1990 by Jules Pretty, who is now Emeritus Professor of Environment and Society at the University of Essex and a noted voice in sustainable living. His paper, published in the Agricultural History Review and called Sustainable Agriculture in the Middle Ages, the English Manor, makes the argument that the medieval peasantry highly valued the goals of sustainability, stability, and equitability. Like Ian Mortimer, Pretty stresses the importance of neighborly cooperation. Villagers traded ale, cereals, hay, livestock, and wood, and hired out livestock, plows, harrows, and carts. Secondly, they provided support and mutual help for each other, particularly through crop and plow team sharing arrangements. Peasants lent grain, livestock, tools, and household utensils to needy neighbors, though these arrangements were more common between small and middle landowners. Thirdly, communal decisions were taken against individuals who had attempted to overconsume or underinvest in the communal resources. In particular, those who had encroached onto the common wastes, had overused the commons, overgleaned the fields, or had neglected their obligations to maintain roads, ditches, hedges, and gate. In the Middle Ages, communities sourced most of their food and raw materials from their locality. Of course, they were also very mindful of not wasting what they did produce. All parts of the animals they kept were eaten, and they consumed the old animals rather than the young ones, so that they could be sure of getting all of the resources, milk, wool, that sort of thing, from them in life. They made sure that they returned what they could to the land. They worked as well. The use of animal and human excrement for manure was a major concern. And when it came to building materials, they were very happy to reuse stone and timbers from old structures whenever they could. You only have to look at the Roman bricks in the great Norman tower of St. Albans Cathedral to see that. In his new book, Mortimer's A to Z of English History, Mortimer succinctly explains this, and he let me quote a few paragraphs here. Today, few of us keep vats of urine stored around the house. But up until the 19th century, it is collected and put to use in fueling wood and scouring cloth, as well as being employed in various dyeing processes. It is in demand because it's a natural and cheap source of ammonia, which is an alkali. People also use spots of it when removing stains from clothing. It becomes more efficacious when it is old, so people really do store vats of it for long periods of time. Thus, when you imagine the smells in an ordinary medieval home, along with the smoke and traces of rotting offal in the rushes, add the smell of stale piss. The point here is not to laugh at how gross life was in the past. It is rather that people in the pre-industrial age look at things that we think of as undesirable in different ways. In the 1960s, sociologist Mary Douglas famously observed that there is objectively no such thing as dirt, but rather what we call dirt is simply matter out of place. A good example is manure. In the garden, it is definitely in the right place. In the middle of your living room carpet, it is dirt. This is why medieval people keep hold of things that neither you nor I would want lingering around the house. In a world created by God, everything has its right place. Usefulness is the key, or sustainability, as we might call it. Medieval people keep old ashes from the hearth to make potash, which is used for scouring pots and pans with handfuls of straw. They also use potash for making lye, in which you wash your hair, even though it is strongly alkaline. It is also a key ingredient of liquid soap, in which you clean your clothes. Likewise, medieval people will eat all manner of offal that we would throw away. Apples are kept carefully for a full year. If they turn rotten, they are pressed to make cider. Nothing is wasted. Bones are boiled for their marrow. Fat is stored in dripping pans. Skins from all sorts of animals, including goats, dogs, and cats, are made into gloves. Fallen boughs and sticks are put aside for firewood. The heat that remains in an oven after the bread has been baked is used to make small cakes. Waste not, want not is the motto by which everyone lives unless they are rich enough to be a waster, and even the wasters let their cast-offs and rubbish be used by other people. Almost nothing is thrown away except broken pottery and the cloth used to wipe your nether end. In our interview, I didn't chat to Ian about the repair culture in the Middle Ages very much, but we did a fascinating interview on the History Extra podcast a little while ago with the German medievalist, Professor Annette Kennel, author of The Green Ages, Medieval Innovations in Sustainability. And she explained how the repair business was a thriving one in European medieval cities, with people making their livelihood by repairing clothes, shoes, and household goods. Community decline. So if you think of the three R's of sustainability, reduce, reuse, recycle, the people of the Middle Ages were absolutely living the second and third values in that list, but not so much the first. Reducing consumption wasn't really in the gift of most people, with the limited resources available to them, though Ian Mortimer does note that the strictures of the church in terms of not eating meat does play into that. You could take the view that the restriction on eating meat across Wednesdays, Fridays, and Saturdays in the Catholic Church was not just a spiritual thing, but also about eking out protein because you don't need to eat meat every single day. Eating fish as opposed to meat then naturally balances things out. To conclude, Mortimer's message, drawing on his knowledge of the Middle Ages, is that if we want to live sustainability today, necessities all need to be local and all need to be transported within the locality in a way that's reliable and energy efficient and low cost. There are problems with that. It's much more difficult to buy locally if you happen to live in a modern conurbation. As is regularly reported, it's often much more expensive to buy locally produced foods than it is to get imported products to a supermarket. But there are urban cooperative movements springing up across the UK that are trying to address those problems. It's been argued and counter-argued that the decline of neighborliness occurred in the post-medieval period as the ethical code of the old village community unwound in the face of a more individualistic behavior of the 16th and 17th centuries. That debate has been going on among social historians of early modern England for decades, and it carries on still. I'm not going to get into that one here, but perhaps the message is that locality, community, and sustainability fit together. That certainly was the case in the medieval ages, and maybe that's something we should think about today. If we want to live sustainably, we need to think about how we live as local communities and cooperate harmoniously. You're listening to the BBC History Magazine on Sunsounds of Arizona. I'm your volunteer reader, Kim Chupa Cornell. Up next, give away your worries like an ancient Mesopotamian. What we can learn about managing worry from the people of Assyria and Babylonia. Dr. Selena Wisdom shares some ancient wisdom with Dave Musgrove. Do you worry about things? Do you wake up in the middle of the night sweating about what might happen to you, to your family, or to the world in general? I do. If you do too, rest assured you're not alone. It's a natural human trait, and it's something people have been doing for millennia. In evolutionary terms, I imagine it's something to do with forcing our minds to think about the things we ought to be doing next to keep ourselves alive and keep us out of dangerous situations. It's counterproductive, of course, to worry yourself into a state of paralysis. That's when worrying goes wrong. So are there any lessons we can take from history that can help us worry productively? I went to the Assyria galleries in the British Museum late one Friday afternoon to reflect on this. They are well worth a visit, whether you're a worrier or not. Turn left at the main entrance and you're straight into them. I wanted to go there because Dr. Selena Wisdom, an expert on the history and heritage of ancient Mesopotamia and author of the excellent The Library of Ancient Wisdom, had told me these people were worriers of renown. They worry so much that they invent an entire branch of scholarship devoted to it. This is worrying on a kind of national cosmic scale. This organized worrying was called lamentation. It wasn't just a private matter. It was ritualized, institutionalized, and shared across the whole society. We know they worried and lamented because they wrote about it. I wanted to get up close and personal with some Mesopotamian cuneiform script. I can't read it, and there aren't many people who can. But I figured it would be instructive just to look at it. Cuneiform is a writing system that they used in Mesopotamia. It was invented in the mid-4th millennia BC and used for millennia afterward, although it evolved on the way. It was basically a system of signs inscribed on clay tablets, produced by pressing a wedge into a piece of clay to make a three-dimensional impression. By studying those cuneiform writings, Assyriologists like Winsome have been able to understand a great deal about life in ancient Mesopotamia and research how these people saw their world. It is a world, as Dr. Winsome explained to me, that was full of worry and worriers. Tense relations. Let's take a moment for a quick recap on where and when we're talking about. Mesopotamia is a geographical term. It means between the rivers, and the rivers in question are the Tigris and Euphrates, so broadly where modern Iraq is. Mesopotamia was a focus for ancient civilizations from the 4th millennium BC onwards. Assyria and Babylonia were two of those civilizations, Assyria to the north and Babylonia to the south. Relations between these two kingdoms in the 1st millennium BC were, in Dr. Wisdom's words, tense. Her book focuses on the time of the last great Assyrian king, Ashurbanipal, who reigned in the mid-century 7th century BC from his splendid capital in Nivea. His brother was king of Babylonia, and is so often the way, the siblings fell out and went to war. The upshot was Assyrian victory over Babylon. However, a few decades after his death, revenge was served when the Babylonians and their allies descended on Nivea and reduced this mighty city to rubble in 1612 BC. Its remains are now to be found on the outskirts of Mosul. The destruction of Nivea included the burning of the Great Library, the Library of Ancient Wisdom in Dr. Wisdom's book title. You might imagine that a raging fire in a great library would be a very bad thing for later historians. However, because the ancient Mesopotamians used clay tablets, the conflagration acted like a giant kiln and fired the tablets, making them more likely to survive for posterity. Crushed and forgotten though these tablets were, their subsequent rediscovery in the 19th century provides a huge source of material for us to understand how these people saw the world around them. quite a lot of the writings in Ashurbanipal's library have found their way to the British Museum, along with reliefs, sculptures, and statues. And that's how we know what the Babylonians and Assyrians worried about. To understand the central role of worry in ancient Mesopotamia, you've got to appreciate the scale and sophistication of the civilizations. Assyria was one of the great powers of the ancient world, known for its military strength, monumental architecture, and extensive bureaucracy. Professional lamenters. The Babylonians were renowned for their scholarship and cosmopolitan culture. Babylon became a center of religious ritual, law, and intellectual life. Assyrian and Babylonian fortunes rose and fell, turn by turn, over the centuries. As Dr. Winsdom notes in her book, Assyrian culture owes so much to the Babylonians that the two can be difficult to disentangle. She likes to use the term Mesopotamian to refer to aspects of their culture that are shared, as well relating to earlier Sumerian texts. They were guardians of knowledge stretching back 1,000 years before them, she says, inheriting and preserving earlier Sumerian traditions. This long memory brought with it an equally enduring awareness of the risks of natural disaster. Flood, fire, and famine were things they knew and feared. They also knew that the way to avoid catastrophe was to keep their gods happy. Mesopotamian gods, says Dr. Wisdom, behave much like human beings do. They have strong personalities. They can be persuaded. They can be tricked. They do things. They care. They intervene. And people are really trying to get their attention and call them over to their side. In a society where fear of the gods was interwoven with daily life, ritualized expression of worry were not eccentric. They were essential. These were advanced societies, but their cultural sophistication did not free them from fear. Quite the opposite. They believed the world was sustained by divine order, and that disorder, famine, floods, illness, invasion, meant something had gone wrong in the human relationship with the gods. Misfortune wasn't random. It was a message. And so they acted regularly and ritually to express their anxieties and to try to restore divine favor. They lament to the gods in the temples every single day, says Dr. Winsdom. They have people whose job it is to sing in front of the gods 4 times a day, these very, very long litanies, bewailing all of the potential things that could go wrong to the city. These professional lamenters were essentially state-appointed national worriers. Their job was to imagine worst-case scenarios in elaborate poetic form and recite them in public ceremonies, even when no immediate crisis was at hand. If you make it clear to the gods that you know they could do all these terrible things to you, says Dr. Winsdom, then they won't feel the need to do it. Ritualizing anxiety. The NHS's Every Mind Matters platform offers guidance on how to manage persistent worrying using self-help CBT techniques. These include identifying whether a worry is hypothetical or practical, writing worries down to gain distance from them, and allocating a set time each day to process them. Techniques that echo the Assyrian practice of ritualizing anxiety through structured lamentation. But if the scale and solemnity of Mesopotamian lamentation sounds distant and weird, hang on for a second to consider how we've reacted to disaster and threat in Britain in recent times. Since 1535, there have been over 500 national days of prayer in England and Wales alone. These were not mere religious observances. They were formal, state-sanctioned rituals in response to national anxiety. In 1548, during the English Reformation, the government commissioned bishops to write special prayers and readings to be used across parishes. Congregants were instructed to fast, wear modest clothing, study scripture, give alms, and refrain from entertainment. Charles II in 1666 ordered a day of solemn fasting and humiliation after the Great Fire devastated the capital. But there were also days of thanksgiving when the nation had been delivered from disaster, such as after Trafalgar, and Waterloo in the early 19th century. More recently, in May 1940, just days after becoming Prime Minister, Winston Churchill approved a National Day of Prayer in response to the crisis unfolding in France. When news broke of the Dunkirk evacuation success 5 days later, many saw it as divine deliverance. Would it even be going too far to suggest that the begging of pots and pans outside during COVID was the latest iteration of lamentation and Thanksgiving in a more secular Britain? Were we trying to hammer away our worries about the pandemic as much as to say thanks to NHS and first responders? The Assyrian and Babylonian response to anxiety was, in many ways, deeply pragmatic. It acknowledged fear as part of life and sought to engage with it openly and communally. There were specialists to diagnose it, rituals to manage it, and no expectation that individuals should bear it alone. They show us that naming our fears, expressing them in structured ways, and seeking support from others are timeless strategies for resilience. As Dr. Wisdom reflects, even the king of Assyria was admitting to feeling rubbish, something we can all relate to. The problem with this is in our practical application today. We can't instruct a temple of professional lamenters to take our worries off our shoulders. But maybe there is something basic here in terms of personal delegation of worrying. One night I was very worried about something, Dr. Wisdom said. Nobody was awake, so I called a friend in America. He said to me, "Don't worry, I will hold your worries until morning." And it actually worked. I got back to sleep. So if perhaps the method of delegation is a little alien when we compare ourselves to the ancient Mesopotamians, the underlying concept works. Delegate your worries to someone else, or something else, and you might find the demon within more manageable to deal with. You've been listening to the BBC History Magazine on Sunsounds of Arizona. I'm your volunteer reader, Kim Chupa Cornell. Music is Classical Royal British Music by Delio Sound. Join us next time for an upcoming episode.